Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Northland Views. We'll be reading today from the White Mountain Independent. And from Pine Top is the headline, Navajo Sheriff Confirms Details in Pine Top Homicide Investigation and Calls for Compassion, a story by Suzanne Adams Okrasa. At a press conference held on December 29th in person and streamed to media from both Arizona and California, Navajo County Sheriff David Klaus confirmed some of the details of the investigation into the death of Carrie Ann Abadi in her Pine Top home back on November 20th. Klaus also called for compassion for both Carrie Ann and Michael Abadi's families. "We had a terrible homicide that occurred in our county. There's a family that's been affected by this. Let's remember that," Klaus said, briefly getting emotional. He went on to say, "When we speak of the victim, we'll speak in reverence. We'll speak in respect for them, and we will not make a parade of this incident." Klaus also reminded the audience that the defendant in the case, Michael Abadi, also has constitutional rights and is considered innocent until proven guilty in court. Klaus confirmed that the Navajo County Sheriff's Office received a 911 medical emergency call from a family member around 9:19 in the evening on November 20th from Carrie Ann Abadi's home in the 4100 block of Broadway in Pine Top. Emergency medical staff from Pine Top Fire District quickly determined that Carrie Ann, age 59, had significant injuries from a gunshot wound and called for law enforcement to respond to the scene. Carrie Ann Abadi was transported to Summit Healthcare Regional Medical Center in Sholo and was pronounced deceased a short time later. The Associated Press reported on December 29th that an autopsy report from the Coconino County Medical Examiner's Office stated that Carrie Ann Abadi died from a gunshot wound to the head and that investigators found a circular defect in a window. Investigators theorized in the report that the gunshot may have come from outside of the home. Carrie Ann was born and raised in the Pine Top area and later married Michael Abadi, currently age 63, who was from El Centro, California, in the 1990s. The couple lived in California and have three adult children. Michael Abadi's family is well known for its agricultural business in the Imperial Valley area of California. Law enforcement officers from the Navajo County Sheriff's Office and the Pine Top Lakeside Police Department spent 4 days searching the home, canvassing the neighborhood for witnesses and evidence, including surveillance footage from doorbell and other security cameras in the area, and talking with friends and family of Carrie Ann, Klaus said. Detectives learned that Carrie Ann had moved back to the Pine Top area about 2 to 3 years earlier during a separation from Michael Abadi. Around November 23rd, detectives contacted law enforcement in El Central, California, including the Imperial Valley Sheriff's and County Attorney's offices, to aid in conducting interviews with the Abadi family, friends, and co-workers who lived there in the area. Klaus said, "A lot of information was obtained and we started to develop some investigative leads." Detectives returned to California for a second investigative trip between November 30th to December 5th, and search warrants were served in three different locations, including the Abadi's residence and businesses. They also collected additional technological evidence, including surveillance video from multiple locations, and conducted additional canvasses of the area. That information was currently sealed under a court order and could not be discussed, Klaus went on to say. During that time, a suspect was identified in Michael Abadi, Klaus said. He went on to say, "We had strong reason to believe that Mr. Abadi had traveled from El Central, California on November 20th to Pine Top, committed the homicide, and traveled back to California early the morning of November 21st. Detectives gave the information to the Navajo County Attorney's Office, which presented the evidence to a grand jury on December 23rd. The grand jury indicted Michael Abadi on charge of first-degree murder, and a warrant was issued for his arrest. deputies from the Imperial County Sheriff's Office arrested Michael on December 23rd without incident, and he's currently being held in the Imperial County Jail. An order to extradite Michael to Navajo County had been issued, Klaus said. Due to security concerns, Klaus said he could not release a date that Michael might arrive in Navajo County. During questions from the media, Klaus and Deputy Chief Bruce Tucker, who was the Support Services Commander for the Navajo County Sheriff's Office, gave details on what kind of evidence was gathered during the investigation, including whether a gun was found, what might have happened in the home that led to Carrie Ann's death, and how the evidence led to the arrest of Michael Abadi. Both men cited concerns that release of that type of information might compromise the investigation. Klaus said he could not speak to what Michael's motive might have been in the shooting. He did say the detectives are looking into all possible reasons as to why the incident may have happened, including whether the family was under a financial strain. He also referred a question about whether Michael Abadi had threatened to take his own life during his arrest to the Imperial Valley Sheriff's Office. As an update to that story is the headline, Pine Top Murder Suspect Arrives in Navajo County Sheriff's Office Jail, a staff report dated today, December 31st. The Navajo County Sheriff's Office confirmed that Michael Abadi, age 63, from El Centro, California, was extradited from California and booked into the county jail at 3:55 p.m. on December 30th. Abadi is charged with first-degree murder in the death of his wife, Carrie Ann Abadi, on November 20th in her home in Pine Top. He was scheduled for an initial appearance before a Navajo County Superior Court judge at 9:30 this morning. At that hearing, Abadi was formally notified of the charges against him. And from Eager, we have the headline, Eager backs Coronado National Gas Conversion, approves grants, fireworks, and America 250 plans. An article by Jen Morea. The Eager Town Council moved quickly through a full agenda at its December 2nd meeting, highlighted by unanimous approval of a support letter backing Salt River Project's request to convert the Coronado Generating Station to natural gas. Eager Town Council members voted 5-0 to approve the letter, which supports SRP, Salt River Project's, application to amend its Arizona Corporation Commission Certificate of Environmental Compatibility for the Coronado Generating Station. In the letter, the town cited the need for stable, reliable electricity as Arizona continues to grow, particularly as a possible hub for data centers and other energy-intensive industries. The letter also emphasized the importance of maintaining family-supporting jobs and long-term economic stability for Eager and the surrounding White Mountain communities. Mayor Guy Phelps and council members William Greenwood, Bryce Burnham, Ray Hamblin, and Titan Morrell voted in favor. Vice Mayor Marcia Tucker and Councilman Brandon Slate were absent. America 250 time capsule moves forward. As part of the upcoming America 250 celebration, the town council voted by 5-0 to partner with the Springerville Eager Regional Chamber of Commerce on a community time capsule project. Discussion indicated that the chamber and the town will collaborate on placement, funding for purchase and installation, and a future ceremonial opening with a 4th of July identified as a potential target date. In a separate unanimous vote, council appointed Burnham and Jessica Vaughn to serve on the chamber's White Mountain Business and Tourism Alliance Committee. Parks, Public Safety, and Fireworks Planning. The Eager Town Council approved acceptance of a Game Time Playground grant in the amount of $16,626 and authorized the use of $50,000 already budgeted for playground equipment. The council also approved the purchase and reimbursement of a utility terrain vehicle through a Salt River Project grant. According to the award documentation, Salt River Project will provide $37,830 to the Round Valley Fire and Medical Department to enhance public safety and response capabilities in Eager and the surrounding area. Planning ahead for community celebrations, the Council approved the purchase of fireworks for the 2026 4th of July show from Casabella Pyrotechnics, not to exceed the sum of $32,000. Staff noted that ordering early helps avoid potential cost increases and that fundraising and donations traditionally help offset the town's expenses. And from Sholo is the headline. Sholo welcomes the new police chief and advances the sports center, an article by Tony Gibbons. Sholo officially welcomed its 16th police chief and moved its long-planned sports and events center into the next phase of design during a wide-ranging city council meeting on December 9th that also highlighted the community's volunteers, seniors, and youth. City Manager Morgan Brown introduced new police chief Greg Westover, noting that Westover's appointment followed a competitive hiring process and that he began in the role about a week before the council meeting. Brian said Westover brings 24 years of law enforcement experience, including 20 years with the Phoenix Police Department and the last four with Sholo Police. He grew up in Joseph City, and his wife, Dustin, is from Round Valley. They've been married nearly 24 years and have two children. Most recently, Westover served as the department's operational support commander, overseeing criminal investigations, records, animal control, school resource officers, and the regional communications center that supports multiple police and fire agencies across the White Mountains. Brown said Westover helped create the strong momentum the department is experiencing today, spearheading a regional major incident team, data-driven strategies that reduce calls for service and crime, and community outreach programs receiving outstanding public feedback. Brown also highlighted Westover's education and leadership training, including a master's degree in criminal justice from ASU, a bachelor's degree from NAU, a graduation certificate in criminal justice education from the University of Virginia, and graduation from the FBI National Academy. Westover has worked closely with federal agencies, managed major incidents, and led units ranging from internal affairs to the Airport Bureau at Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix. You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Northland Views. And now we turn to Heber Overgaard with a headline, Heber Overgaard Clinic Ready for New Medical Team, a story by Tony Gibbons. A fresh coat of paint, reconditioned flooring, and a repaved parking lot are the latest signs of renewal at the Heber Overgaard Community Medical Center, a building that has always been less about walls and wiring and more about people who pulled together to create it. After the previous medical group chose not to renew its lease at the end of October, the Mugion Medical Foundation, or MMF, the volunteer-run nonprofit that oversees the building and serves as its landlord, moved quickly to restore and refresh the clinic in preparation for its next chapter. That chapter is set to begin in January when Premier Mountain Healthcare plans to open its doors. We wanted to get it into tip-top shape for them, says Ruth Ann Smith, one of the original members of the Heber Overgaard Economic Development Corporation and now a longtime board member of MMF. She says the providers who came here looked at the demographics, at the needs. Early on, it was the small county doctors. It has grown and evolved into what it needs to be, and Premier Mountain Healthcare is ramping up big time. The interior of the building has been repainted, the parking lot resurfaced, and the flooring reconditioned. By the end of December, Smith said, PMHC will begin setting up the clinic. They want to be able to see patients later in January, Smith said. The facelift marks the latest milestone in a story that began more than 30 years ago with a simple idea and a gift of land. In the early 1990s, longtime residents Owen and Mary Ann Kelly believed that Heber and Overgaard, two small communities with limited medical options, deserved a full-time clinic of their own. They donated 10 acres of commercial land for that purpose with two conditions. A medical building had to be completed within 10 years or the property would revert back to the family. And secondly, the acreage could never be sold, with future development restricted to medical support services only. It started with a little bit of money and 10 acres of land and the idea that we could do something medical for this community, Smith said. She went on to say, when people realized this was the biggest need, everything just took off. The Kelly's donation sparked the creation of the EDC, which became the organizing force behind the project. For Smith, who joined the organization in 1991, the early years were marked not only by planning and fundraisers, but also by human stories that began weaving the community together. With enough funds, labor, and material donated, an old-fashioned barn raising took place on June 14th back in 1997. Contractors and community members from across the region gathered to build the clinic's exterior, beginning work at 6 in the morning and ending about 12 hours later. We had 15 to 20 people working on each side of the building, Smith said. Contractors oversaw the four sides. The booms came in. Doctors even came up from Payson just to be part of it. Over the course of the long day, over 100 people came by bringing food and helping out or just watching the progress. Children played in the dirt, and even Nurse Good Hands the Clown was on site to entertain them all. It was a family affair, Smith said. If you could pound a nail, great. If not, we had you picking up nails. By dusk, the exterior walls were standing. And from St. John's, the headline, St. John's Council reviews mandatory trash service and tables wireless facilities ordinance, a story by Jen Morea. The St. John's City Council met December 10th to review a proposed ordinance that would require garbage service for certain residences. They tabled an emergency ordinance related to wireless facilities and approved actions involving fire department equipment and a public safety retirement policy. Council held a first review of a proposed ordinance that would require garbage collection service for all residences receiving city utility service within the St. John's city limits. Staff said the ordinance is aimed at addressing public health and safety concerns related to garbage service. Council members asked questions about how the ordinance would be enforced, how costs would be assessed, and whether exemptions could apply for certain properties. Members also discussed residents who haul their own trash and how compliance would be verified. Staff noted the proposal remains in an early review stage and would require additional language and policy direction before moving forward. Council also discussed whether the city should assume billing responsibilities for Blue Hills Environmental. Members raised questions about potential administrative concerns, customer service considerations, and whether city-managed billing would simplify collections or create additional workload for staff. No action was taken, and the council directed that the discussion continue at a future council meeting. Council also discussed an emergency ordinance intended to address emissions in the city's zoning code relating to wireless communication facilities in agricultural and reserve districts. Staff explained that required tables and site development standards were inadvertently omitted from a prior zoning ordinance, resulting in a regulatory gap. During discussion, council members reviewed proposed height limits, including language related to monopole facilities, and identified the need to correct section references and terminology. Staff said a table outlining development standards was missing from the adopted code and would be restored under the proposed ordinance. Council also discussed the city's authority to regulate wireless facilities under federal law, including how local standards intersect with Federal Communications Commission requirements, as well as visual compatibility and other aesthetic considerations. Staff said the ordinance was proposed as an emergency measure to take effect immediately and retroactively to the date of the original ordinance. The council ultimately chose to table the item for further review and corrections. And from the White Mountain Apache Tribe is the headline, One Man's Mission to Restore Carrizo Church, article by Tony Gibbons. 2 years after flames destroyed most of the little church in Carrizo, the burned-out building still stands as a reminder of what the community lost. For 33-year-old Kyle McCabe, who lives in Sholo and has spent nearly a decade helping families across the White Mountain Apache communities, the site of the damaged church in Carrizo became a turning point. For outsiders, it was just a building, McCabe said. But for the people there, it meant something special. It didn't just provide time with God. It also provided second chances and a place to gather. Having lost so many friends and people I considered in my heart to be family on the reservation, sometimes second chances are all I need, McCabe said. For McCabe, who most people on the reservation simply call Dash Keen, which is white boy in Apache, the loss of that church lit a fire in his own heart that hasn't gone out. One day I realized it wasn't just a thought, McCabe said. It was God telling me, rebuild my house so my children have a place to go. McCabe began by placing 15 donation jars around local businesses, hoping to raise enough money to begin repairs. 3 weeks later, he counted the contents of those 15 jars, $12. $9,200, not $12,000, $12, McCabe said. For a moment, it broke him, McCabe said, but only for a moment. Noah didn't tell God he didn't have the money for the ark, he just built it. Despite the slow start, McCabe continues moving forward, now aiming to have the church rebuilt by Easter Sunday, 2026. While the Carrizo Church Project is his largest undertaking, McCabe's connection to the reservation began 10 years ago with a simple work trip into Cibecue. He expected to spend the day buying antlers. What he found instead was a community facing challenges that reshaped his understanding of need. I went to buy antlers, McCabe said. That was it, just work. Instead, he met families living in difficult conditions and children with few resources. The experience, he said, hit hard and shifted his priorities. Before I even made the first dollar, I knew I just couldn't come back here for business, McCabe said. I had to come back for the people. Since then, McCabe has returned year after year, using his earnings to support families and supply Christmas gifts to children across the White Mountain Apache communities. McCabe's Christmas tradition has become a staple in the community he serves. With many families facing seasonal hardship, he uses what he earns buying antlers and doing taxidermy to fill trucks with toys, clothing, and essentials for holiday delivery. They care deeply, McCabe said, of the family he helps. Life is just heavier here. Work is scarce. Bills are crushing. Some winters are just too long. 1 year, McCabe raised about $10,000, enough to provide gifts to more than 200 children. I used to love Christmas for the presents, McCabe said. Now I love it for the kids' faces and the relief from the parents who just want their children to enjoy such a magical day as Christmas. And finally, we wrap up this edition of Northland Views with a sports story. Defense. Four and double figures powers Sholo past Payson in girls basketball. A story by Keith Morris. Senior Lacey Peters scored 13 points to lead four Cougars in double figures as Sholo beat visiting Payson by a score of 57-34 in girls basketball on December 19th for Sholo's fourth straight win. In a matchup of former 3A East rivals, Sholo led by a score 11-3 early on. It was 11-7 after one quarter. But then the Longhorns went on an 11-3 run over on their own as Tatum McDowell scored an inside basket to tie the game at 14-14 with about 3 minutes remaining in the first half. But Sholo closed strong, outscoring Pacing by a score of 10-2 to end the half up 24-16. Peter's jumper capped a 16-2 run, putting the home team ahead by a score of 30-16 with just 5:19 to play in the third quarter. A 15-11 third quarter advantage left the Cougars up by 12 with 8 minutes to go. Sholo put the game away in the fourth quarter and stretched the lead to 27 points by a score of 57-30 before the Payson Longhorns scored the final four. Sholo extended its winning streak against Payson to 14 games, dating back to a 42-35 Longhorns win at Payson in the 3A East tournament back on February 9, 2018. Nine seniors dominate Sholo's roster. Five of them led the offense. Along with Peter's 13 points, Tatum Moore and Jordan Boyce both scored 11 points. Jalen Boyce scored 10, including 9 in the first half, and Riley Gaston chipped in 8 points, all in the fourth quarter. It's the second most points Payson has allowed, behind only a 65-35 loss to Chandler Valley Christian. It's a big win for the three-time defending 3A East champions, who forced 30 turnovers by the defending 3A Metro champs. "We focused on the defense," said Sholo coach Christy Francis. The Cougars limited Payson to its second lowest point total of the season. Payson lost by a score of 49-25 against Yuma Catholic for its only loss in four games in the Payson Holiday Hoops Invitational back on December 12th and 13th. Payson finished third. Freshman B.B. Wee and sophomore Nelly Whaley both scored 8 points to lead the Longhorns. Payson, with an 8-3 and a 5-2 ranking, was coming off a thrilling 35-34 home run over Florence on Tuesday. The Longhorns had their best season ever last year. They reached the 3A final for the first time, losing to Snowflake for the title. Sholo beat Snowflake in the quarterfinals, but lost in the Copper Open semifinals. The Longhorns lost in the first round of the Copper tournament and dropped with Snowflake into the 3A tourney and reached the title game. It was a good test for the Cougars, who are improving as they close the 2025 portion of the schedule. Of course, they looked at Friday's game like every other. Well, this wraps up another edition of Northland Views. This is Wallace Kleindienst, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.